You're listening to The Industrial Movement, where we discuss the people, the processes, and the equipment that drives American manufacturing. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. The Industrial Movement podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and the show notes can be found at our website at www.theindustrialmovement.com. Come back often and feel free to add this podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow the show on Twitter at The Industrial Movement or on our Facebook page. All links to our social media can be found in the show notes and also at the bottom of our website. Now, let's get on to the show. Hi, folks. Welcome to The Industrial Movement. My name is Morty Hodge, your show host. And with me, as always, my trusty sidekick, Greg Smith.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show.
Today, we have Kenneth Scruggs from BMW Manufacturing joining us on The Industrial Movement. Kenneth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about your career and what brought you to BMW. I see that you've been there for 26 and a half years, which is amazing. You don't see that loyalty like you used to. And so tell us a little bit about what brought you to this point in your career.
What brought me to BMW, I started off in retail sales, Lowe's and Home Depot. I just kind of fell into it. BMW put a two-page ad in the paper asking for production associates back in 1993. And I just knew that at that point, the money was better then because it was the biggest manufacturing plant that was going to be in the area at that time in the Greenville-Spartanburg area in South Carolina. Put the ad in the paper, started in 95. It took them 2 years to get me hired because it was such a long process. BMW didn't actually see my application until step nine. Everything before that was handled by the state of South Carolina, which could explain some of the turnover issues we had talked about a few minutes ago. But also, my first job there was sanding cars. Cars came in, you feel the car for defects, and I sanded them. Didn't actually get really on top of them, things there until about 2005. I got my first offline job, and that was a reworker, which got my fire kind of up to kind of be more involved and get deeper into the decision-making process. And from there, put in for my first management job and started in 07 in the management team. So I've been with them since 2007 in the management team. And all this time has been in the paint shop as well. So I never have done anything other than assembly and body, but just in the paint shop.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about what BMW is doing there in the Greenville, South Carolina area, the products that they have, and maybe a little bit of history about BMW.
BMW came to the area in 93, started off. Originally, we were only going to make about 250 to 300 cars a day, as compared to right now, I'm painting 1,850 cars per day. And that's on day shift and night shift combined. Started off, I was going to do some Z3 was the original model that we started back. We were going to do some overflow from some 3 series. We did some 318s. But as the area showed that it had a good core workforce at the time, they just added more and more to it. And then BMW since then has grown. Our clock numbers for our BMW associates right now is up to 19,308. And so I'm 1,445, kind of give you an idea of how much it's gone. So it's, and right now we're expanding like you wouldn't believe. They just announced the metal press plant. I don't know if you guys saw that or not, but it's a press plant. It's going to be a 220,000 square foot facility. It's going to be an additional 220 jobs. And we're going to start doing some of the single hang-on parts, pressing our own parts, and bring them across. And we've also are adding right now a warehouse facility. They're building a bridge across I-85 just for moving the parts to BMW from warehouse to BMW. It's just growing in leaps and bounds right now. And the models we make are the X3, the X4, the X5, the X6, the X7, and we're going to start an X9, which is in a new model phase right now.
Wow. Do you know the history or any history or notable events about BMW and their history?
Just from the start of the company started doing airplane engines way back in actually World War II. BMW designed the first jet engine, and that was in the Raisenberg and the Dingolfing plants. Got into motorcycles. At one point, the company itself was going to be sold. Majority owners was the Quant family. They still owned it. The workers had a meeting on the floor. It's one of the most famous things with BMW. They had a little meeting on the floor and talked him into not selling his controlling stock interest, which, as you can tell, paid off well for him from that meeting. And so, and our plant, Plant Spartanburg, is the largest exporter of automobiles in America. It's also the X5 is the highest selling volume model for BMW.
Wow, that is very interesting. Greg?
So let's talk about overcoming obstacles. What's the biggest challenge your industry is facing today and maybe in 10 years?
Right now, manpower is an issue we're facing right now. That's also going to be the problem. You have a lot of people vetted like myself who have been there from the early 90s. I started in 95. The earliest people started 2 years before that. And there's a difference that I'm seeing from being there from when I started when I was 25 and I'm about to turn 52 in the work ethic of the different generations. It's just something that seems to jump out at me. And there's a lot of people around my age in the next 10 years that, you know, are going to be leaving the plant. They're retiring. They've been there from the start, and some will go sooner, some will go later. And but with the next 10 years, there's going to be a huge void to be filled. And it's a matter of getting the right talent in the right places right now for BMW. They're going to have to make sure that the company's got to make it very attractive to keep some of the younger people involved, because the opportunities are there for them. I mean, in the next 10 years, it's going to be so wide open at so many management positions. It's just a matter of finding the right motivated associates who want to take advantage of that. And part of the problem that we've seen, when I started at BMW, it was the only huge manufacturing plant around. You had GE, but BMW was paying so much, and it was automobile, first automobile, full manufacturer in South Carolina. It was exciting. Right now, there's a lot of competition. You know, Volvo is just up the street in Charleston. I've got a Charleston's also got a Mercedes van plant. So there's a lot of other bigger companies that moved in supplier-wise because of BMW, and it's affecting the manpower, where to pull manpower from, because now I've got associates. The pay scales at the beginning are similar to what other companies start off at. So they're getting pulled different directions. And at BMW, when you go full-time BMW as an associate, you do start on night shift. It's a seniority thing. And a lot of the younger associates don't like nights. And they have a job that maybe it pays a dollar less an hour right now. But for them, that's not a big deal because they're not thinking 5 years down the road, which is what it takes to get the top pay at BMW currently in manufacturing is 5 years.
Very interesting. As far as personal mastery as a leader in manufacturing, what advice would you give somebody in the younger generation that wanted to pursue a career similar to yours?
I would say learn as much as you can about the area you're immediately over, and then learn and then expand from there and work your way out and learn the rest of your shop. And also, when it comes to management, the one thing that I found associates appreciate the most is consistency. If you waver, and one day you're to the left, one way you're to the right, then you're in the middle. And it's associates will get frustrated with that. They know me. I'm one of the more strict managers there, but they know what to expect, and they know my expectations of them. And if you make that clear, 99% of your associates will meet the expectations if you make them clear. And so my advice is whatever line you draw in the sand in management, I like to tell them, is, you know, stick to that. There's no, to my mind, there's no right or wrong. Some are really on the lighter side and some are more on the strict side. But whatever that spot you pick, whatever that line in the sand that you draw, stick to that line and be consistent with your associates. And then from there, the knowledge that you just learn about your area. It's one thing I like to teach people that work with me and for me. Know if you're not moving cars, go look through our screens and find out where the stoppage is. Know how to cars progress through the paint shop. Know what part comes next, where your bottlenecks are. Every shop's got its bottlenecks. Learn that area and kind of learn your surroundings. The more you have situational awareness of the surroundings around you, it's going to make a huge difference in your advancement, your understanding of the situation, and your decision-making process. When something goes wrong, you will be able to actually cut off problems before they happen sometimes. Or you can almost look into the crystal ball and, hey, I can see this is going to be an issue up here because they're slowing down here. It's going to stop me soon.
Talk to us about any books or resources that have helped you along your way.
I'll tell you a resource that helped me. There's a gentleman on LinkedIn named Mike Grunston. I don't know if you guys have checked him out, but he had a book called The Power of One. And he's got this great little, I guess it's like a theory, where the closer you are to a problem, the more you understand the problem. And I read that book, and it was about putting out fires and how to be more of a leader and a manager, because sometimes we have to manage and get specific and say, okay, we need to do this, we have to do this. And other times we want to be a leader. We want our associates to understand their piece of the puzzle. What they do in their jobs is very important, how it fits together in the overall landscape. And getting them to to problem solve themselves and have buy-in is huge. And that was a great resource that I really enjoyed. If you guys have to check him out on here, he's got a page too, and he's really good. And also, they put me in a lot of management training classes. Like currently, I'm in one called iLead, which is I'm just about to finish that up, which is something that BMW put together. And it's kind of the same situation, trying to make sure we're not using so much emotional, but using our better thinking skills, problem solving, and think before you speak. What am I saying? Is it important? Make sure you know you're calm before you speak to an associate, because we're dealing with the generation gap. I can say that it has gotten some of the respect that used to be there, at least in my perception. It takes a lot more to get that respect now, to earn the respect from the associates coming in.
What was the name of that book and the author again?
Mike Grunston. It was The Power of One.
It's a similar concept to, you know, our parents, and we grew up in a generation where it was command and control, and now it's more inspire and enroll. That's the generation. That's what they're looking for.
Yes, that is true. Well, let's face it, we stayed out, you know, all night, you know, until the street lights came. You know how it goes. And then my parents sat there, and, you know, if I did something wrong, I got lit up. You know, my dad was a 20-year military man in the Navy. My mom was Air Force. We moved around for the first 10 years I was born, settled in Spartanburg in 79, because that's where both parents were from, and they were strict on me. I didn't, until I graduated high school, I had an 11 o'clock curfew, even in summertime. I mean, they were very strict on us, for sure. And that makes a difference. And then we were kind of also, I think, pushed to, hey, make your life, become your own person, you know, go out and earn a living. And I think what I'm running into, a lot of my younger generation that I work with now still live at home later in their 20s, and some of them even in their 30s are living at home right now, which kind of takes that responsibility. If you don't have bills, you don't have responsibility. Your buy-in is, you know, is, hey, do I go to work today or do I stay home and watch this game? You know, you kind of get caught in that quandary there. So,
during your career and your life, who were a couple of people who have influenced you the most?
My shop manager is a gentleman named Scott Gregory. He understands so much about a paint shop and the automotive industry. He started straight out of high school working for Honda plant up in Indiana. And he came down to BMW when they opened in 93. The way he understands the floor and the way he can predict what's going to happen and tackles the problems, and very sociable though. I mean, he's been a department manager there, which means he's run the entire paint shop nights and days since 1998. So he's been that department manager that long. He really understands the flow of cars. He understands people. And the associates, he'll walk by, he'll have a great conversation with you. And another inspiration, I think, for me, that's been someone who's been a good friend, and also at times we've been colleagues. Now he's my boss. He got promoted again. His name is John Braswell. John's a very calm individual. We used to have a thing saying that, hey, John's like E.F. Hutton. When he talks, everyone listens, because he doesn't talk unless he's got something to say, which I always tell him. I said, I need to learn that from you, because I have inserted my foot in my mouth in many meetings. So John is really good at knowing when to speak. And when he does, it's always something of value. It's something of great value. And those two are on the opposite ends of the personality spectrum. Well, John is reserved and, you know, like I said, the E.F. Hutton. Scott Gregory is full force, boom, out on the floor, 100 miles a minute. You know, he's different there. But I've taken from both of them, and trying to sit there, and with Gregory, I've learned to be aggressive on the floor, learning how to move cars, to tell the associates the specific expectations that we need. And from John, I've learned sometimes to be calm and say, okay, wait, why am I talking? And let's let the associate talk for a second. Give them a chance to hear what they have to say. And sometimes it's better, if your comment is not going to add any value, to hold that comment in. And John's taught me a lot of that. So, but two different ends of the spectrum, but two great teachers.
One of the most powerful segments we have on the show is lessons learned and challenges. That's some valuable content we can share with the listeners. So tell us about some of the biggest lessons that you've learned over your career and some of the takeaways.
Some of the lessons I've learned specifically, I've learned that, like we just said, kind of the same thing, be patient sometimes. One of the anthems we use, like I said, is wait, why am I talking? Because as me being a type A personality, I have a tendency to want to jump into a conversation before I get all the information. If you've ever done that, you know, sometimes like, oh, maybe I should have got a little more details with it. And so that's, I've learned, like I said, to think before I speak. It's a situation that I think that a lot of the managers, we want to put out the fires. We want to jump in and fix things. And sometimes we need to let the associate fix their own problem so they can learn from it. And we need to not push them towards a solution, but let them lead themselves towards a solution and let them kind of understand that. And I think that the industry itself, I think we've learned something from the chip problem. I don't know how those chips, most of them, the V chip, were coming from overseas. And I'm pretty sure from this lesson learned from there, having multiple distributors for different parts is going to be a huge issue, because that one distributor really almost hurt the automotive industry across the board. I mean, everyone was struggling getting those V chips in. It didn't affect us so much at Plant Spartanburg, but it's definitely a lesson learned. They'll be looking for some other suppliers and trying to get some different people involved in that now. That's a big one to take away as well.
Why do you think it didn't affect you guys so much at BMW Spartanburg?
That was specific because the X5 being the top selling model, they chips that were going to different plants got directed to us based on sales and volume. And so that's worked in our favor a lot. And it's now with the push to go everything electric, some of the are going that chips are going to go that direction toward their plants where they're going to be more of the electric plants, which is back in Germany. But to this point, we've been very fortunate. It hasn't really affected us at all. We've had a couple days just recently where we, in one shop, making the X3 and the X4, they didn't run a shift. They just, a 12-hour shift. But other than that, for the actual X5 production, it has never slowed down, never stopped yet right now. So it's moving full speed ahead. And those other, the X3 and X4, that just happened like 2 weeks ago.
So it was more of an internal decision. You guys were able to focus your resources toward your top sellers.
Yes, sir. Exactly what we did.
That makes sense.
Besides the workforce issue you already spoke about, what are some other day-to-day challenges you face in your position?
Dealing with, we're one company, but yet we're three individual departments inside of that company, body shop, paint, and assembly. Dealing with our counterparts, even though there's only four walls in the building, it's really like three individual companies inside of one. And sometimes it's you have the tendency where you don't want to be the problem. But you have to be open-minded when you're problem-solving and realize this isn't about paint, this isn't about body, this isn't about assembly, this is about the customer at the end of the line paying for that car. That's what you've got to realize and understand that. And since I've been doing this since 07, I've gotten fairly well good at that. Okay, let's take a step back and make sure I'm looking at everything that can be happening inside of paint that might be causing this particular defect. Sometimes I've met some individuals who their first thought is to, it's not me. Well, wait, we haven't even got a chance to discuss the problem. Let's slow down. Let's take a minute and see what's going on. And it's all about charging cost centers. Like I said, even though it's one company, you don't want your cost center to be charged for this particular scrap car, or this particular defect where you have to eat the rework minutes and different things like that. So communication within, they call that the silo, within the silo of the manufacturing industry. And I'm sure it's at other plants too. When I was in retail sales, it was the lumber department versus, the hardware department, so to speak, kind of that kind of thing. It's kind of the same thing, but on a much bigger scale in BMW because it's so big. And that's something that they send us to classes with other individuals from different departments to try to work on, to build up communications. And it's important to have that because in the long run, we have to remember, what's the end goal? What's the thing that we're driving for the most? And that is to get as many defect-free cars through each shop as quick as possible, because if it goes into a repair bay, you're taking it out of the loop and you're adding cost to the vehicle straight through a direct ship out the door to a customer's driveway.
Talk to us a little bit about the processes at BMW. What is your typical day at your facility? How does the flow of cars go? Walk us through that process.
In body shop, parts are shipped in. We don't do any stamping right now. We're going to soon, but that's going to open in 2024. But right now, all the stamping parts come from different distributors, from the side outers to the floor pans, the roofs. They all come in sitting in racks to body shop, where they go through different processes getting welded together. You know, the doors get put on, hatches put on, the hoods, the actual body outers get welded to the roofs and the floor pans. Now, paint shop, the first area it hits is my area. My specific area of expertise is corrosion, specifically with the phosphating e-coating side of that. Cars come in and we go through 11 tanks because, you know, with body shop, you have to leave some oil on the cars or you get oxidation, you get rust. So these cars come in with a light film of oil and some grease on them. We put them through a cleaning process first to get those as clean as possible. And then the one part of that that makes everything work is your phosphate coating. And that's a zinc-based product that if you look under a microphone, it looks like little grains of rice etched into the surface. And there's 11 tanks that this car goes through. And then it goes over to our e-coating process, which is the corrosion coating. This is what's going to stop that thing from rusting because BMWs have a 12-year rust guarantee. And so it's one of the best out there in the industry. So you have to make sure we're backing that up. And the E-coat is electrically deposited on the car with 450 volts. We have rectifiers that charge up this bath and they go through and it gets attached to that. And then this is comes out, goes through an oven. The oven's an hour and 5 minute oven. Temperatures get up to 475 degrees in that oven on the exterior surface to bake that E-coat on. And then from there, we go into our what we call our UBS sealing process, because all those panels that body shop puts on, you're going to have gaps. So you seal with PVC on the bottom of it. It's a polyvinyl chloride product to specifically make sure you don't have any leaks. And first you go through the inside of the car and under the hood, and then you go to UBS, which is underbody, which is everything underneath the body. And then we do our hem seals, which is on our doors. Of course, we have quality checks at each station. And then we go to our through another oven to cook that PVC. Comes out to E-coat sand, which is where I first originally started as an associate, where the shop has got, you know, you wear clean suits, you keep the doors closed, but there's still going to be dirt in the atmosphere. It's just in the system, it's just process that gets, you know, people bringing it on their clothes, gets on the car, gets cooked, you got to sand it off. So E-coat sand's the next one, which that's a crucial point in the process, because if they don't get everything off that car, it's painted. And once it's painted, now it's turned into a spot repair or a major repair, which means you're either repainting a part on a car or you're repainting the entire car, which is, there again, it's taken longer to complete that process and it goes back through the loop. And anytime you're putting more man hours into the car, we're going into the profitability of the car. But let's say it's a great car. They do their job. It gets painted. It goes to polish bays. That's the final inspection to make sure everything is polished out. And inside clean room, I should get a little more detail there. We have a base coat first, which is the base coat for the color. We have the actual little oven that cooks that called an ICFO oven. Then we go to clear coat, gets car, you know, clear coated. And the robots actually go and open the door, spraying the cut ins, spray, you know, outside under the hoods, all that is sprayed. And then it goes into a clear coat oven. And then it hits our polish bays. They completely polish out any defects, because at this point you've got a painted car with clear coat, basically a finished product from the paint's perspective. One more stop through a cavity wax, which is just for aesthetics, making sure that that ride is as quiet as possible. And then to assembly, and assembly hits different stages. It goes through and they start with the vent etch first thing. They're putting the vent etch on the car, unless it's going to Russia. Russia cars do not get vent etches. Not sure about that one. Vent etched goes through, gets a the doors get taken off and pulled to a separate line. The car goes to a tilt. They are putting, at this point, all the different wiring, clips for the wiring, and it goes through the process of that. Then it goes across the shop to glass, comes back through and gets an underbody exhaust put on. From there, gets to the final inspection with the wheels are installed, goes down F2 to fluid fill, and then F1. And then if everything runs as smooth as possible, out the door, customers, and loading on to the train cars taking it to Charleston or cross country.
Awesome.
That was in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, that was awesome. Talk to us about some processes or systems you guys have in place to maintain the efficiency and productivity there.
Specifically, to make things the quality efficient, because quality is always the biggest thing. We have what's called KPIs, which is key process indicators. You guys might have heard that in the industry. You know, we have different things. We have a internal audit group, and we have a QZ audit group. Our QZ audit group is for the entire plant. My internal is just for paint. We do each model inside the paint shop gets audited so many times per week inside for each individual technology. Corrosion has an audit, application has an audit, and finish has an audit. They're basically making sure that we're staying in the standards that we need to be in. And they're really particular. They're super picky, which is good. I'd rather be picky inside the shop, because on the actual QZ audit, which is the main plant audit, paint shop does very well. It's very rare if we get a hit because we're really, really particular on detail. Of course, that is in our control process. That's the thing, exterior of the car. Now, assembly is a little tougher because there is only so much automation you can have in assembly, just because of that nature of that beast. And there's a lot of variation in their process. In comparison, paint shop, when you do a particular process, it doesn't change really from model to model. There might be a different touch or feel or a stroke of a brush when you're working in underbody, but more or less, it's the same thing. But assembly's got so much variation. So they have a lot tougher time with the audits and making sure everything's good. They have to do more internal audits, and they have to have a lot of more quality checks along the way. At the end of each process and each line, they have a quality check. That's what keeps us on the quality side. And then, of course, we have different environmental audits, because I'm also over the wastewater group in our plant, and we have to make sure that we discharge at a certain level, a certain pH at any time, because we're in Greer. CPW can come in and take a sample there anytime they want, and the EPA can come in and take a sample anytime they want to come in and see what we're discharging. We create most of the waste in paint because of just the process itself, you know, with all the robots, you're spraying paint and clear coat. You got those volatiles in the air. If you guys have ever sprayed a spray can in the union, how it kind of hangs, it's the same thing. So we have downdrafts that pull this down into in some of the boosts, it's a water-based boost, and some of them are a powder-based, a limestone. But the water-based goes into a sludge. We kind of separate the sludge out, and then it goes to my wastewater group to make sure that we're meeting our environmental standards. And we treat that. We go through different reaction tanks to try to add polymer, because we want the sludge to flock together so we can pull that out. And then we discharge it at a certain pH. And one thing that we've added within the last 8 years, we've started recycling some of that waste stream to make our own DI water through reverse osmosis. Once we get it to where we're calling it clean water, where we've got it to the levels that they want, we ship it back to this holding tank and we run it through these carbon filters, and it basically gets that clean enough. And then we go through the actual DI process, and then we use that back into our processes, which that's been a big one because water conservation, I can actually, make out of that system 400,000 gallons of water in a week. And so that's how much less I'm discharging as compared to where. And you multiply that times 4 weeks, and it's huge. So that's one of the things to try to keep us on the edge of that. Because then, of course, we have international shipping audits to keep us up and make sure our processes are good. TÜV comes in. We have to get TÜV certified, is one of the big ones that comes in, to make sure that all of our process sheets are up to date. Like for each individual process, we have a process sheet that shows associate go A, B, C, D, E, and something that they can find on our sign-in system, so they can make sure that they're understand what they're doing. And each individual associate has a sign-in process, so we know who worked on this car at this time. And so those are all just different pieces of it that helps keep our quality, our shipping standards, our standards of discharge, the waste, all the things that kind of get with the paint shop and all. So
in the next 10 years, where do you see manufacturing in the United States? Which direction do you see it heading?
Definitely more automation. I tell you, it's going to be more and more automation. So I always tell people right now, hey, if you can get anything with the robots where you're actually going in and programming them and this and that, that's a field that's about to explode because we are going more automated. When I started, our UBS department had zero robots. Right now, the entire thing is automated. I think last count was 62. That's a rough guess trying to remember. As compared to when I started, it was zero. And while that was manual back then, the more you can get with that. And then on-time delivery, customers can go in now. It's a big thing where as the car moves through the process, if you decided you wanted to change the interior color, you have a certain point in the process of the production to change it. And once it hits a certain checkpoint, you can't. That's become more popular with the customers where they get to look, I think I wanted the tan seats instead of the white because it's a little bit, the white will pick up dirt more. And they can actually change that. That's one of the big changes I've seen. And of course, electric vehicles are going to be the way. All the big ones are putting a lot of manufacturing into the electric vehicles right now. Now, we don't do any of that at our plant currently. We do have some hybrids that have the electrical charge port, PHEVs we call them. We do have some of those. I think with the next 10 years, I think you're going to see more and more effort be put towards the electric side or the hybrid side of that, the PHEVs.
Let's talk about some of the equipment. You just mentioned you got a lot of robotics. What other type of equipment do you guys use in your facility?
My eco system is a row dip system, and we got two shops, north and south. I guess I should say that. South is older. Our south shop, our eco system, came online in 2009, and then we started our north eco system in 2014. North is an improvement over south. We lessons learned, and we made things different. So we've got two different types of systems there. We've got the row dip system, which is where a car is loaded on a carrier, and that carrier has guides and these and wheels on the actual carriers, and when the wheel hits the guide, it turns, and then it goes through, and you're going nose first into each bath and doing a complete flip coming in and out. That's getting you complete coverage. That's getting your car the internal panels, because you've got to think about internal panels, making sure they get e-coated and phosphated as well. The better system right now is my shuttle system in paint shop north. Each individual carrier has a motor. And so let's just say, which we all have downtime, something happens. You can raise the other carriers out of the line. If you got one carrier that's messed up, all the other carriers on the line can be raised out of the bath. In my south shop, when you're down, you're down. You got to get it fixed as quick as possible and, get that going. But north has a much better system that way. It's something that's a lot better. And the other equipment, like we talked about, that reverse osmosis system, and I don't know all the details with that one because that's a newer one. I have not got a chance to work with it as much. But with that and changing that wastewater stream back into DI, reusable water, that is something that's really been a huge impact with the numbers we talked about. Very big impact with that.
Does your company have energy efficiency initiatives? And if so, tell us about some of those goals.
I am not involved in that as much because we actually have an energy center. It's its own. We make some of our own power, and some of that we sell back to Greer. But I have been in the building once, unfortunately. So I do not have a lot of actual information about that part of it. But it is a huge part, and that's it's actually next door between the two paint shops. It's just it's an area that, like I said, as much as we're one company, when you get in your individual technology, you don't get to get out a lot because there's doing that so many cars we're doing. Like my north shop does 352 a day, and my south shop does 533, per shift. 352 a shift, 533 a shift. And so that keeps you busy on both sides. I'm actually covering both shops too for my areas, but I do not have as much information as I should probably have on that energy center. But
what is a common myth about your profession or field that you would want to debunk?
A lot of people think that it's pushing buttons, all pushing buttons. It's gotten more that way. It's definitely gotten more that way. It has gotten more automated, but there is still a lot of manual process in the automotive industry. It's still a lot of manual. From putting fixtures in to going under the car and brushing with your hand, like we have robots that do all the PVC application, but you're also looking at tack time. You're trying to do a car per minute. Is what your tack time, when time you take out your brakes and lunch, that gets you your volume a lot. But rather, we could program a robot to go and hit every single nook and cranny in the car. But then you're looking at going over your 60-second tack time, and that tack time includes shuttling time, which is 14 seconds. So you can kind of see how that gets tight. And so you want to try to make sure that you're keeping that way, and that keeps everything going through and trying to keep in that set time to make sure we get that number going across the board.
Oh, thank you. What is one thing that you would want to share to our listeners that would help them become better leaders?
I still stick with listening to the problems, listening to the associates. And once you get an associate's buy-in, that is key to what we do. When they want to do well and you show them, hey, look, what you do here, it doesn't seem, because everything is broken up in such small pieces. It doesn't seem like you putting this fixture in is a big deal. But in the long run, if this fixture is not in right, the car doesn't get painted right, customers waiting for a car. And, I use a lot of acronyms at work and kind of compare things that really aren't apples and oranges, It's not apples to apples. I'll say, if you're at Burger King and they mess your burger up, you're going to go to McDonald's. It's similar. If you aren't happy with BMW, they'll go to, you know, to Audi, they'll go to Mercedes, they'll go somewhere else. And getting them that buy-in and letting them see that what their piece is important, and for them to understand, you know, hey, I can make a difference. And then getting them to see the opportunities that they have. I mean, when I was in high school, you guys might remember Miami Vice. I wanted to be Crockett when I was growing up. I'm gonna be a cop. I did some police work in Spartanburg for a little while, and I realized Crockett was crooked because he wasn't getting all that on a policeman's salary with the boat and the Ferrari and the alligator named Elvis. I'm sorry, I'm getting off track. But the opportunity that the young people have right now is absolutely amazing. And like we talked about earlier, in the next 10 years, oh, it's just going to open up so much for them. If you got some who are career driven and who see the opportunity that's right there in front of them. That's one of the biggest things, is letting the associates understand their part and making them see how much advancement they can have if they choose to have it.
We had a guest on the other day. He's in the oil industry, a vice president of manufacturing, and he told us that automation, same thing you did, one of the biggest upcoming opportunities for the younger generation is robotics programming, and that you can go to school for 6 months, get out of school, and within a year, you're making six figures. And that opportunity was not there for us a generation or two ago.
No.
So you're exactly right.
It was not.
You're exactly right. There's a ton of opportunity in manufacturing for this younger generation. And I think that's part of what we try to do, is spread the word about this industry is exciting. There's a lot of cool things with technology coming up on the horizon that is really going to be interesting for the younger generation to get involved in.
I think it's a matter, too, of them wanting to get involved. That's what's frustrating, too, because, you know, my first full-time job was Lowe's. And I went from $3.85 an hour part-time to $4.50 an hour. I'm like, Mom, I'm moving out. I'm making $4.50 an hour. I'm on my own. I'm going to buy, like Crockett, a boat and a car, you know, because that didn't happen. And it's frustrating because there have so many more opportunities than we did. And I don't think some of them realize it. Or maybe they will. Well, the hope is that they see it as they go on. But it's definitely what we did not have those opportunities. And the industry just in my area was just not there at all. So big difference.
Kenneth, one of our goals is to create a community of manufacturing leaders. How can our listeners connect with you?
The easiest way to connect with me is on LinkedIn. I'm on there as Ken Scruggs, BMW Manufacturing. I have a lot of people reaching out to me overseas asking about BMW, and I always send them the contact information because BMW's got plants in so many different places, and I send them the contact information. But if anyone's interested, yeah, LinkedIn's the best way to reach out to me. Just go on there and send me a message or send me a request, and I always let everyone join who sends me something, and then just send me a direct message to the system.
Great. Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us on the Industrial Movement today. It was a pleasure to get to know you.
I appreciate it, Jim. I hope you'll have me back later on.
Absolutely.
Yes, I learned a lot today, and hopefully our listeners will as well.
Hey, if you guys are ever in the area, I'll give you a tour of the plant. How about that? Next time you're in Spartanburg,
that'd be great.
We'll get you through there.
Thank you, sir. You have a good day.
You too, Jim. Thank you very much.
Well, folks, that's it for this week's episode. Be sure to visit our website, www.theindustrialmovement.com, to view today's show notes and get more golden nuggets of value that we have collected from manufacturing and industrial professionals in our archived episodes. On our website, you can also sign up for our newsletter and find links to join the Industrial Movement community on Facebook. The Industrial Movement podcast is where we discuss the people, the process, and the equipment that drives American manufacturing. I'm your host, Morty Hodge, wishing you great success.